Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Elizabeth Carney. I'm with the club's Business and Leadership Forum and your host for today's program, which is entitled Googleization and the Future of Books. We invite our audience to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org to learn about many of the fine program events held here at the club. It is now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Siva Vadidahantha, and conversation with Brewster Kahle. I think that we'll spend the first 10 minutes or so with Siva talking about his book. We're lucky to be able to have Siva tonight. He's written a book called The Googleization of Everything and Why We Should Worry. Those copies of those books will be available afterwards. Then for about a half an hour, Brewster and Siva will be in conversation. And then after that, we'll spend about 20 minutes or so with audience questions. Siva, would you like to begin?
Sure. Thank you very much for coming out tonight. This is an event I've been looking forward to for many months. I've long paid attention to the events at the Commonwealth Club, and as a person who writes books and often likes to go out and talk about them, this is sort of one of the maybe top five gigs you can pull down. So I'm really thrilled with it. And thank you so much for coming out on what was, until just a few minutes ago, I understand, a very rainy evening. But you know the weather better than I do. So when I decide to write a book, it's largely because I don't know much about it, the subject. I'm motivated to write books out of unshakable curiosity and often dangerous naivete. And I learned many things in the process of writing this book. Most importantly, one should never try to write a book about Google. That was a terribly frustrating process. This is an entity, an animal that does something big, new, and powerful every month. And to try to keep track of that is maddening. To try to imagine that you're actually done and you've made sense of the issues of the moment, of the conflicts, it's impossible to conclude. And so this was a book that seemed impossible to finish. Fortunately, I finished it, or my editor's demands finished it, right? She finally got fed up with the delays. There was one huge delay that had a lot to do with the motivation for doing the book in the first place, and that had to do with books. And so I'm thrilled so many people showed up here tonight to talk about the future of books. Brewster Kahle is going to join me in our sort of joint musings about what might happen to books in the future, and of course we'll be dipping back into our deep appreciation for what books have meant to us as well. Now, books obviously meant a lot to me. I practically grew up in libraries, and I've written a couple of them, and much of the good stuff that's flowed to me in my life came out of the experiences of researching and writing and then talking about the books that I've produced. In 2004, in late 2004, I was sort of between projects. I had just recently published my second book called The Anarchist in the Library, and I didn't know what I wanted to do next. I was at the time mostly planning on starting a family, becoming a father, and that took a tremendous amount of attention. But I knew I wasn't in a hurry to start something. But then, late 2004, Google announced that it had the intention of scanning in the entire collection of the University of Michigan Library and significant portions of the libraries of Stanford, Harvard, the New York Public Library, and the Bodleian Library at Oxford. And the way that this project was described was a library project. Of course, they're in partnership with this handful of libraries, which has now grown to a list of, I don't know, somewhere between 50 and 70. I don't know that anyone actually knows the total number of institutions that are participating in this scanning project with with Google. But the way that people at Google described it and the way that the people in the library community, at least not necessarily rank-and-file librarians, but the heads of libraries described it, was this was an effort to extend the reach of libraries in our lives and perhaps even help preserve the collections of libraries. And this immediately struck me as both audacious and absurd. And there were a couple of reasons for this. Audacious because this was a six-year-old company at the time. 2004, Google was 6 years old. Right now, it's almost 13. It'll be 13 in the fall. Its voice is just starting to change. Right? We've just started to figure out how to live with the environment that Google has mastered. Right? We've had the web in our lives for about 15 years, most of us. Some of us a little bit earlier. But you know, that's just a blip. We've barely figured out how to deal comfortably with this medium. I'm not even sure we have. But back in 2004, it was all so much fresher and so much more fluid. And as I said, this was a six-year-old company. A six-year-old company that had already shown that it could sell ads like nobody's business. A six-year-old company that had already shown that it can matter in people's lives in a pretty stunning way. It was already far and above the leader in its core mission, organizing search results. Its actual mission statement, the corporate mission statement, is to organize the world's information to make it universally accessible. And so I was struck by the audacity of this, right? A six-year-old company. And mind you, in 2004, at that point, Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston had been married for longer than Google had been around, right? So, and, you know, the universities it was dealing with are hundreds of years old, right? They were dealing with Oxford here and Harvard here and even Michigan. And I started thinking, like, these universities have been around for a long time. They've been in this business of organizing information and granting access, often way too restricted. But that, you know, that's really what they were here for. Universities were actually founded as huge copy machines. They were just the added-on services of the libraries created by the monks who founded them in Europe. And so it just seemed weird that these institutions would entrust this six-year-old company as the custodian of so many centuries of knowledge. Now, that's not even speaking to the qualitative issues. Whether Google was in a position to do this well didn't seem to be on anyone's agenda at the time, or very few people's agenda, right? The notion that Google had in its essential mode of doing business the collection and tracking of our interests and habits didn't seem to strike any of the folks who had cut these deals with Google as troubling, right? Libraries have had for about 100 years a very strong commitment to maintaining some protection for patrons, for users, so that we can enjoy a certain level of confidence and intellectual comfort as we travel through our reading and our research and our searching, knowing that we can go into areas of thought that may be controversial or may be risky, and that librarians are not going to turn us in to the people who might imprison us or beat us up because we're looking in certain books. That's been a really important part of the history of librarianship and the history of these institutions, and didn't seem to be part of the concern in the rush to digitize as much as possible and let Google link to it and serve us up a list. The quality question of how well Google could actually serve that list didn't seem to be part of the equation either. There was nothing in these contracts that I could see that governed how well the search functions would work. We know that Google's done a great job with helping us search the web, but that's largely based on the beautiful technology of the link, and there's no such thing in a book collection. So I kept wondering, if you're doing a book search, how do you know that one book is superior to another or one book is more relevant than another? There didn't seem to be an obvious answer, and no one at Google was talking about it, and no one in the library was talking about it. And then there were the quality questions of whether Google's scanning process was actually going to get every page or get every page without fingers in the middle of it, and whether the actual image quality was going to be good enough to do the sorts of work that scholars need to do on it, whether the image quality and the entire system was going to be durable, was going to last 50 to 100 years or longer, right? Because books last a long time. So why would we give up the durability of the book for this? And then the very notion that it seemed like a grand experiment in corporate welfare really bugged me, that the universities, many of them public universities, were giving away the riches, giving away millions of dollars, perhaps in total billions of dollars, of collected material to a private entity for the sake of building it into a profit-making venture. So the whole thing seemed upside down to me. And it also struck me that we were missing an opportunity. We were missing an opportunity to talk about how we might actually build a global digital collection or a global digital library, for that matter, and they're not always the same thing, that might actually spread information, good quality information, in a safe way to corners of the world that had yet to experience the benefits that you and I have experienced. And I thought, you know, we have the tools to do it. We have the interest in it. People write about it and talk about it all the time. I'm not sure we have the political will to do it the right way. And clearly the expediency that Google offered seemed to be trumping all other values. I'm not that old a guy, but I kept finding myself saying, hold on, young fellas. You know, there are long-term values here that we have to pay attention to and hard questions that we have to ask. And it seemed odd that important, powerful people were not willing to ask or confront these questions. So I hadn't decided at that point to write a book, but I had decided to write about the Google Books Project. And as I started writing about it, I started getting a lot of reaction from some people I respect very, very dearly, because they couldn't believe that I was taking on the good guys, right? Google's the good guys. Google's at least not Microsoft, right? So that, they had something going for them there. And in terms of copyright issues, which, you know, I had been involved in those battles for a number of years, Google had always seemed to be on the side of the interest of the user, of the public, largely because Google is a copyright user and produces copyrighted work as well, but isn't into this culture of protection. So it struck me as odd that a lot of people who I thought would be raising hard questions about Google's role in this wanted everyone to be quiet and just let Google run with it. And because there was a copyright battle at the heart of whether Google could get away with this, I found myself actually in arguments with people with whom I had been in the trenches for many years. And that was weird as well. And for all of these reasons, I decided I really have to pursue this further. And in reading around about Google, I came across a quote from Sergey Brin, in which he, one of the co-founders of Google, he had been asked by a reporter, what would the perfect search engine be like? And he said, it would be like the mind of God. And that's when I decided I had to write a book, right? Because that's not only audacious and bold, that's blasphemous, right? So, and I started thinking about it, like, oh man, this company, it's omnipotent, right? It's so rich, it's omniscient, it knows everything about us, it's omnipresent, it's in every part of culture, right? And it pretends to be benevolent, right? This is a great theological story here. And I started thinking about the ways we use Google in our lives and the fact that we trust it so much, and most of us tend not to want to peer behind the beautiful clean interface and try to get a sense of how and why Google does what it does. And when you do that, and this comes in large part from my view of the healthier ways to view technology, if you're actually curious about how something like Google works and you can delve into it a little bit and get to understand it a little bit, two things happen. One, it becomes a lot less mystical and a lot less magical, and yet it becomes worthy of respect. Once you start looking at the actual work that the people who work at Google do to do all of this for us and with us and to us, you start to get a real deep sense of the craftspersonship that goes into this kind of work. And you can be in awe of the intellectual problems that they set out for themselves to solve and in many cases did solve, like translation. The fact that people at Google have figured out ways to translate between two distant, obscure languages without actually having to have a human translator there, is stunning. And when you try to sort of unpack how that happened through a tremendous accumulation of text and data and sort of mathematical associations and the constant process of trying to figure out how the sentence works in all these various languages. I mean, the sentence is actually a pretty brilliant invention if you think about it. And so I ended up just in awe of the people who actually do that kind of work. But I also feel that if you understand that, you not only get a sense of deep human respect for that sort of craftspersonship, but you also are in a position to be unafraid to raise difficult questions about the effects and the influences of this company and of this technology and of companies and technologies in general. And so that really is what motivated me to do this book. But it started with a deep concern and curiosity about the culture of books, the future of books, and the role that Google is playing in terms of libraries and what role it would play in our experience of books in the future. Soon after the Google Books project was announced, the summer after, Kevin Kelly, one of the founding editors of Wired Magazine, wrote an article in the New York Times Magazine in which he extrapolated from the Google vision a future in which all knowledge would be unbound, freed, liberated from the constraints of the cloth binding. And he found he considered this to be a vision worth working toward, right? That this would actually that as knowledge sat within the covers of a book, it was somehow inadequate and not fully engaged with the world. And I found I find almost everything he writes to be troublesome and simplistic. And what bugged me most was his choice of how he views the future. He's actually a professional futurist, which has got to be a good job. I wouldn't mind applying for such a job in the future, but I would have to know the future, right? But he always says that things will happen, not that things should happen, not that things might happen, not that things could happen if piece A, B, and C all fall into line, but that things will happen. You will live in a world without bound books. You will live in a world in which all book knowledge is then liberated piece by piece and then remixed by all of us. Well, you know, I'm willing to say we might live in that world. I'm not willing to say we should live in that world, and I'm certainly not willing to say we will do anything. I think that's weak thinking to know the future, to pretend to know the future. I thought the Bills would win 4 Super Bowls, so what do I know, right? So immediately after that, John Updike responded in a disappointing way. He responded in an essay on the last page of the New York Times Book Review about 2 weeks later. And it was based on a speech he gave to the American Association of Publishers. And in this speech, he lamented the end of book culture as he grew up with it. And he did all the wrong moves. Instead of addressing Kelly's point by saying, Kelly's wrong about the predictive part of this story, or Kelly's wrong about the ways that this sort of fluid information world would definitely benefit people, he sort of gave up and said, well, we know what's going to happen, but what we're going to miss are the charming bookstores of my youth in, you know, Cambridge, Massachusetts, or in London, or in Greenwich Village. And that seemed to me to be the exact wrong move, because that was terribly elitist, because most of us never got to hang out in the bookstores of Cambridge or London or New York, and never will. And at least what Kelly was offering was a sense of something close to universal connectivity, which I think has great virtues over the elitist notion that you should be in a special place and within a special community to enjoy the fruits of all this knowledge work. So how can we do both? How can we have and maintain the cohesiveness of the bound text, and I use bound in a positive way, as in we are all bound together, and ideas are bound together in order so that they can be enjoyed in order, and there's nothing wrong with order, and at the same time extend access to all of this knowledge so that we can actually have a fully engaged species, not just polis. So that's, I think, not only the challenge that I tried to address in this book, but I think it's the challenge for all of us, because we are makers of our information ecosystem. And we should not pretend that we're mere consumers or mere objects in this system. We get to choose what e-reader we want, and we get to examine the ramifications of that, and we get to choose whether we want an e-reader, and we get to choose which pieces of information we consume and in what order and what to do with it. And so I really felt strongly that we needed to start this conversation in a way that fully empowered and engaged all of us and really outlined the stakes of what's at work here in this moment of tremendous promise and transition. So I'll stop there, and I'd like to...
Yeah, I was just going to say, Siva, if you're ready, Brewster Kahle has done quite a lot in terms of the democratization of the digital information, and if you would join us, it would be a delight to have the two of you both passionate about the future of the book to be in conversation for a little while. Thank you. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. And great honor to be with Siva. And I highly recommend his book.
Thank you.
It is a very cogent warning of some of the aspects that I think we kind of get caught up in sort of the swirl of convenience and sort of thrill and wealth that really we see all around us in the Silicon Valley area, and takes a broader perspective. And so I'd like to actually start off by asking you a couple questions around some of my favorite quotes
here.
Okay,
sure.
One is sort of, you started out with this this line that I don't think I'd heard quite as well put. I worried that the environment generated by the global reach of the Internet was pulling us in opposite directions towards both anarchy and oligarchy. Yeah. That there's both this sort of decentralization, radical decentralization, lack of control, as well as winner take all. Some people seem to be winning in a huge way. Do you see this as a big, is this central?
I think it is central. It's essential to how I think about our information ecosystems and what's happening to them, especially over the last 15 or 20 years. Because the way that the Internet itself has been designed is to facilitate radical democracy, to facilitate a lack of control. That doesn't mean it's always going to be that way. It doesn't mean it's necessarily that way. But like Jessica Rabbit, it's drawn that way, right? So we have this situation in which our engagement with these technologies actually makes it easy to imagine certain activities and certain environments in which there is no top-down control. And that's tremendously exciting and liberating in a lot of ways. From that, we get projects like Linux, projects like open source and free software, projects like Wikipedia, from this ideology as much as from the technology. And I think the technology and the ideology are married. And when we recognize it that way, and we see that there's a lot of interesting thought at work here and a lot of interesting work at work here, that helps explain a lot of phenomena, not just Wikipedia, but WikiLeaks. It does explain the motivation of a lot of people who are interested in the radical liberation of information. And it doesn't necessarily solve the moral and ethical and legal questions around it, but it does give us some insight into what's at work there. In terms of the oligarchy, one thing we saw very early on as we saw the rapid commercialization of the Internet in the mid-90s is an effort to lock it down, often a futile effort to lock it down. So almost immediately, you start to see the Clinton administration make the policy moves to encourage the privatization and the private investment in Internet infrastructure and commerce in the 90s. And then by 1998, you see Congress pass the Digital Millennium Copyright Act to do what ended up being a futile goal, to achieve the futile goal of locking down content through technology. It was futile because it was just naive about the technology in many ways. But it did cause a tremendous amount of damage to people who wanted to make legitimate use of materials that had been locked down through technological means. And so a lot of my early work was based on what I saw as a fundamental tension. Two schools of thought that are not necessarily best for us as citizens. And so what I ended up arguing with in my second book is what we need to do is invest in institutions that put forth Republican values with a small r. And encourage us to think about community and virtue and mutual obligation. Institutions like the public library, for instance, I thought was a proper model for our information ecosystem. So that's sort of where I left off in 2004 before I marched into this project.
And I commend you for arguing against the good guy, Google, right? It was a lot easier to argue against Microsoft back in the 90s because their products didn't work very well. Google's products actually work really quite well.
Right.
So you get kind of in trouble going and being a critic of Google.
That's why it's so fascinating, right? Because, I mean, I use Google every day. I used it to find my way here, right? And I love it in a lot of ways. I mean,
I'm glad they know you're here, too.
But
you also took on the libraries. One of the quotations that I thought was relatively brave. The main criticism of Google Books has always concerned the actions of the university libraries that have participated with this program. And you mentioned it in your comments. And that's, again, sort of, you know, kicking the good guys. And I've been involved in both putting publishers online and, you know, working to build a library and put libraries online. And this should be the librarian's day.
Yeah.
Right? The internet is, you get paid to give stuff away.
Yeah.
Right? That's what librarians mean. Should be great time for libraries. Yet, they didn't really take to it. There's usually the arguments, well, there's either cost too much or there's copyright. And so there was a program started around 2000, the Million Books Project, mm-hmm. and said, okay, what if we remove the cost? Right? You know, government will pay for the scanners. Government of India and government of China would go and do the digitization. You know, would American libraries then have things digitized? And Raj Reddy and a bunch of us, Carnegie Mellon and a bunch of us went and built this whole thing out, and the libraries didn't come. And it really wasn't until the Google thing came along. And it was sort of this sort of head scratch, sort of, why then? And it might be the control aspect.
They were outsourcing the risk. In terms of, they thought they were outsourcing the risk. That's one of the things. They thought that if someone sues, they'll sue Google, and that's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
So that was an important part of it. It's important also to distinguish between librarians who actually do the work, who are very much engaged with the changes, in fact, leading many of these changes in a positive direction, and library directors, and worst of all, university councils, who are timid and often short-sighted, and in many cases, university presidents who were just so thrilled to be part of the Google universe. And in the case of the University of Michigan and Stanford, those are university presidents who had close relationships in terms of fundraising with the founders of Google. Princeton is close to the former CEO of Google. So there are a lot of relationships there that were working in ways that ran counter to the values of librarianship. The values of librarianship dropped out of the whole equation.
And so we're sort of in this place now. The Google settlement was currently turned down. There are renegotiations going on. And the libraries are kind of refocusing to try to get access to these books again. And it's a bit of an unknown period as to exactly what's going on. And one thing that you said in the end of your comments, which I'm going to jab you with, which is the idea of a global library or a global collection. That was singular.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'm worried about monopoly.
Good.
Whether it's monopoly of a library telling us what it is we should be reading, or a corporation saying what it is we should be reading or where we should going, in any of these states. And building a distributed system in a digital realm is sometimes actually kind of hard.
Yeah.
There are these abilities for winner takes all that really make it quite easy to have, well, you know, once we have Gmail, do we really need Yahoo Mail anymore and Panics or The Well or any of these others once we have somebody getting it done right?
Mm.
So I'd like to ask a question. And so what are the features of this digital library that we want?
Mm.
One thing I would say is we don't want a library. So let's broaden it up. A library system. So how do we have a library system that supports publishers? Again, not one and not five. I think we're down to Mary Merle. Are we down around five major publishers now? That sounds kind of like the record industry, and that's not terribly interesting. So how do we go and have lots of publishers, lots of libraries, lots of readers,
mm-hmm.
lots of authors, running under a rule of law rather mm-hmm. than rule of contract
mm-hmm.
in this future? We're now at a point that this Google thing got people energized. There's still people pining away for it to still work, the original players. But we are at a point where we can do something different. What's the features of the library systems that you want to see?
Oh, I'm looking at it in the most abstract ways, largely because I don't want to prescribe too heavily. I also don't want to proscribe too heavily. I want us to have a 50-year field of vision. I want us to focus on aspects like preservation as much as access. And I want us to focus on the agenda for what it would take to get to the point where, whether it's a system, a library, or a set of interconnected cooperative libraries, however you want to envision it, the important thing is the goal. And the goal is to erase the discrepancies in information access in this world. If we agree that that's a worthy goal, then we can try to map out the best possible way toward it. I'm not sure I have an answer to your question quite so precisely. I'm willing to consider the virtues of all of those models as long as the goal is to empower people. It really should ultimately be about people. I do think, though, that the figure of the library, even if it's singular or plural or merely as an inspiration, helps us focus on the values at work, the values that should be at work. It's not just about connecting people to material. It's not just about a collection. It is about people who have committed their lives to the goal of connecting people to information, and it's about professionally trained people specifically, and it's about exploiting local knowledge and expertise as well as global knowledge and expertise.
So some of the numbers that I look at in the terms of the library system in the United States, according to OCLC, is a $12 billion a year investment, largely on the part of either universities or the public, towards what it is what we've got. $12 billion. About a third or a quarter of that, between $3 and $4 billion, goes to publishers' products. Mm-hmm. Before this talk, we were talking before, and he said, "Well, if it were simple, easy, or cheap, we'd be able to have this digital library." And actually, I'd say it's all of those things. It's simple, easy, and cheap. To go and back digitize all of the materials, as long as people still believe in libraries, mm-hmm. As a distributed, community-based entities, the cost of digitizing a 10 million book library, which is kind of the class of a Boston Public Library, quite a bit larger than the San Francisco Public Library, a Yale or a Princeton, that sort of class system, is about a $200 million project. So it's kind of doable. If you scan at the Google quality, it's more like about a $50 million investment because they're, fast and not that great. But they can move through it. So it's actually cheap enough. Mm-hmm. There's copyright issues of how do you move through that. And what I've learned by doing the Wayback Machine, which some people thought was risky in its day, of copying everybody's website and making it available again, is a key aspect of it is to make sure that you're in concert with other people's business models, and that you're flexible in some way and respectful. Mm-hmm. And that's worked actually quite well. And I think that by going and taking the older books, the things that aren't going to make it onto the Kindle, and bringing them online and lending them out, it's actually working. And we now have 150 libraries doing this based on, there are now a couple million public domain books now available and over 100,000 of these current books. So I think we now have actually a path forward. And I worry personally about the singulars, mm-hmm. the monopolies, especially in the field of books, mm. which books really are how we as a society think things through. Mm-hmm. And having long-form narratives, I think, are pretty important. Your comments that the libraries are sold out in this particular case is sort of distressing. And I'll end this with a question for you on another quotation, which I liked. These days, commercial support for journalism and nonfiction book publishing is eroding. As the information ecosystem we have grown accustomed to over the past 50 years dries up and crumbles. We owe it to ourselves to invest in and support the environment that will enable experimentation and the emergence of new institutions and voices that can foster local Republican values, with a small r, and global democratic culture. Is this where you see us going?
I don't like to predict, but it's where I want us to go. And I want us to keep those ideas in mind as we structure through these things. Like, as we try to figure out what modes of reading we will engage in, I would like us to focus a little bit less on convenience and a little bit more on the long-term effects on our entire, as I say, information ecosystem, on the people who contribute to it, who make this stuff, both in terms of authorship and publishing, and with concern for the fact that broad swaths of humanity should have access to these sorts of materials. And what we're seeing, not to pick on Amazon too much, because after all I'm trying to sell books, is that when you look at the model of the Kindle, it's all about the lockdown of the content. It's all about making sure that the device itself carries forth a particular format and that's incompatible with other formats. And libraries are struggling with ways to extend their collections, their electronic collections, in the shadow of this remarkably pervasive and successful set of formats. So these are the sorts of battles we're fighting out in the short term. But in the long term, I think ultimately we need to invest in libraries, not just as a service, but as a market for this work. Back when libraries didn't have to pour significant portions of their budgets into monopolistic scientific publishers, which is actually what's really killing university libraries right now, a handful of commercial publishers are extorting a tremendous amount of money from university libraries, and in many cases public libraries, you could actually justify the publication of a book based on library sales alone. A publisher would sort of run some projected numbers and figure out that, you know, we'll probably sell 1,200 of these just to libraries, and let's go ahead and run the book. Probably price the book pretty high, but it would justify publication. And now when you estimate library sales for many books, we're thinking in the hundreds rather than the thousands. And that's the sort of thing that's helped dry up a lot of good work and help make a lot of good work unpublishable. And I think in the long run, that's going to hurt us as well. But I'm really curious, from your point of view, what's your motivation for getting involved in this sort of work? I mean, you did so many things before you set about on a similar mission to what I've envisioned. I just sit back and write and talk about stuff. You actually build stuff. So can you tell us a bit of how you got here?
The opportunity building the Library of Alexandria version 2 is not one to pass up.
Okay.
Right? I mean, in terms of one of the things that I think our generation can offer to humanity that may be remembered forever is to be able to have all the books, music, video available to everybody. That opportunity is just a fantastic one, and one that we could screw up. And it certainly wasn't a world that I grew up in, mm-hmm. where there was three channels of nothing on TV, and there was just the New York Times. And I was told what was I was supposed to do until I got to college, when I started to find out, wow, there are people at the edges of knowledge. And this time around, with the Internet, lots of people are at the edge. Lots of people can participate. My kids can actually write things that are online that people of all ages, hundreds of people, can read, and if it's worth it, thousands. And that used to be the land of professors,
right,
to be able to have that kind of a podium. So building that world was really what throws me forward, gets me jumping out of bed, and so unbelievably pissed off when the Google project
tell that story a little bit. What were you up to when you learned of the Google scanning project, and how did that complicate your life?
Actually, the ideas were there, the money, it all could have been done. There was this energy boost that came from Google, both good and bad. It kicked people in the butt. And it said, this is not only possible, we're just going to go off and do it. So that was fabulous and fantastic. And lots of people got behind it. But there were some of us that sort of scratched our heads and said, I don't know. I'm not sure we really know what's going on here. And we asked our librarian buddies, and they said, we can't tell you. Right. We can't show you what the deals were. And when you have to subpoena a librarian to get an answer, you know you're in something's going wrong. So when University of California had it sued out from underneath them and was posted on the net, it started to come out that this stuff was not good, that they were locking up the public domain. And the public domain's small enough as it stands. And they were making this grab for the rest of the collection. But they sort of had this strategy of let's lock up the public domain. And so, yes, you give a copy back, but the libraries get sort of a toxic copy back that they can only use on campus. And that just wasn't the way, you know, this thing was supposed to go. So they weren't doing the right thing. And it really became quite clear when the contracts came out, and then when the settlement came out, there was this what the heck is this? And it came out right around the time of the presidential election, and people weren't really focusing on it. And it was at the end of an EFF board meeting, after they closed it down, I raised my hand in a little sort of, and I said, help! And to try to get help with Google. And this is a time when people were still pretty upbeat about Google. Right. People were sort of really sort of, this is a good thing. Yeah, okay, it could have been better. But, we get the Library of Alexandria, courtesy of Google, and it's free for us. And Pam Samuelson took up that she said, oh, no, Brewster, I'm going to have to read it, aren't I? And I said, yes, please do. And she started reading it and started to fume. And interestingly, it wasn't the librarians protesting that really got things going. It was lawyers, Pam Samuelson, and it was the Justice Department when they came and said this is an antitrust problem because they were
making the settlement. So what had happened was after the lawsuit that 2-3 years went by of sort of discovery and debate, and then ultimately, unbeknownst to all of us, the publishers were negotiating a settlement with Google, and the settlement was a settlement to a class action lawsuit, and the settlement would have established and made clear that Google was not pretending to be a library; it was in fact trying to be a bookstore, and would have been the largest used bookstore in the world. Now, I love used bookstores, and there's nothing wrong with them, but I want used bookstores to be labeled used bookstores and not libraries, and I wanted to keep that distinction very clear. It was still confusing. As late as October of 2010, Sergey Brin was able to write an article in the New York Times op-ed page in which he declared his motivation for pursuing this project was to preserve libraries. Because after all, Stanford's someday going to burn to the ground, but all those server farms, they'll be with us forever, right? And that just, again, struck me as absurd and upside down. Ultimately, many of us, including some important law professors such as Pamela Samuelson, saw that the class action settlement was creating law, changing law and practice and copyright to such a significant degree that it was the wrong forum. You want to change law in this country, you spend a lot of money to fly congressmen to Barbados, right? That's how it's done, right? You don't settle a class action lawsuit among basically three parties. It was the Authors Guild, who, by the way, doesn't represent authors, very many anyway, certainly not me, and the American Association of Publishers, which doesn't represent all publishers, and Google. And there was no representation for the university libraries, no representation for universities in general or for public libraries. And yet, all of these institutions would have been participants and parties to this process. And so the judge, I think, appropriately ruled, Judge Chin in March, that this was the wrong way to do this. Again, he didn't say it as crudely as I did. But if you want to change the law, you got to go to Congress. Congress writes the laws. You can say, I don't trust Congress to do the right thing. Well, tough. It's time to elect people who will do the right thing, right? That's what we signed up for long ago. Fortunately for me, the settlement came out a month after my book came out because I ended up having two chapters in my hard drive. I told you that one of the reasons the book was so late coming about is the Google Books thing, and that's because I had one chapter that says the judge approves the settlement, and another chapter that says the judge rejects the settlement, and I didn't know which one to send. And I was holding off because every Friday it was possible that the judge was going to issue a ruling, right? And I kept telling my editor, no, wait, I think it's going to happen. People are telling me it's going to happen. And it wasn't happening. And all the way through last summer, she was getting very impatient. And she said, look, I got to have something. So I had to write an entire chapter saying, it's all up in the air. And we don't know how the judge is going to rule, but here are the ramifications one way or the other. And that's the chapter that appears in the book. Fortunately for me, the judge did not rule 3 months before the book came out. And waited till the book came out. I'm not sure he actually was out there to help me, but it worked out for me because I was able to churn out a bunch of op-eds and get a lot of attention, sell a lot of books. It was lovely. But now I have to go ahead and write an updated chapter for the paperback.
The book holds up. The book holds up. I mean, and so it's I think
it's not worthless. It's not out of
date. No, it's not out of date. And out of the ashes of I think Judge Chin's bike. Judge Chin's basically saying, no, I'm sorry, you know, you guys, Google Authors Guild, publishers, these big research libraries that sort of crafted this oligarchy, you don't get to walk away with this piece of cake. There are now things coming up, which I find very exciting. So, and I have the pleasure of working with a large number of libraries, about 200 libraries that say, let's do something different. And on the whole, as well as the government of China, which is interesting, are digitizing books at over 1,000 a day that are in copyright books and putting them into pools such that you can borrow them. And it's the public libraries. It's not the university libraries that are used to licensing and these sorts of monopolistic practices. It's actually the public libraries. So if you walk into a Boston Public Library branch or a San Francisco Public Library branch or any of the branches up and down the peninsula, you can actually borrow e-books of scanned materials from the 20th century. It's not everything, but it's the public libraries going and saying, you know, we've got the mandate to do this. We've got the money to do this.
Right.
We have the opportunity now, and frankly, now people are expecting it. That it's just in this last year, e-books have become kind of common. I'm still not seeing lots of Kindles walking around on planes, but it's what librarians and public librarians are trying to figure out how to deliver. They're able to license materials from OverDrive to get some of the current titles, but they're having trouble getting the 20th century. And that's now coming about by libraries themselves, digitizing them, putting them in pools,
right,
and walking forward.
Nothing
and
important so happened in the 20th century, right? We don't really have to understand.
Right, yeah. So actually, I'm quite encouraged. And I think it was Justice Department, it was the government of France and the government of Germany objecting to the Google book settlement, which is really weird. I mean, this is a court case. It's a class action in a district court, right? This isn't the Supreme Court. This is a low-level court. And there's this sort of, you know, a couple people sort of mentioning around something, and they come up with this settlement, and the government of France goes and says, we object. you know, and the Justice Department has to weigh in. And it does speak to sort of the import of what I think of the importance books plays for us. That if it were almost any other media type or something, I think people would have given it a pass. But books are how our society thinks things through, and having one controlling entity isn't the way to move forward.
I think it also speaks to a growing global concern about the influence that Google has in our lives. And that's coupled with an increasing dependence on Google, right? These things go hand in hand. Google usage in Europe is so much higher than Google usage in the United States. In the United States, it's somewhere between 60 and 70%. It's somewhat fluid. Of our searches go through Google, and the remainder go through various versions of Microsoft and Yahoo and Ask and a few others. In Europe, it's almost exclusively Google. In the Netherlands and Portugal, it's more than 96% Google. I actually don't know what other search engines are using over there. I'm not really sure why that's the case. I suspect it has something to do with the legacy of so many Americans having Hotmail and Yahoo as their sort of startup pages, and then your initial search in your daily internet travails come through those pages, but I may be wrong about that. Google's, of course, failing in places like Russia and China. It's It's holding on in a competitive way in South Korea and Japan, but not dominating in either of those places. It's growing tremendously in places like Brazil and India, which, you know, two really good markets to be growing in. But there is a steady wariness about the extent to which this one company touches so many important parts of our lives. And we've been really lucky. For 12 years, Google has not really abused us as much as it could have. But there's really no guarantee that over the next 10 to 20 years, Google's going to run things the same way, or that the same people will run Google. So those are the sorts of things I wanted to remind people about, that anytime you're inviting a private entity into a mixture of or a set of projects that involve public values and public goods, you're taking a risk because private entities have their own imperatives. And they're good imperatives. I mean, they make sense. Like, you know, the fact that companies are there to enhance the value of the shares for their shareholders is a system that generally works pretty well for us, as long as we know to rein it in when it starts messing with us, right? We can rein in the negative externalities if we choose to. Lately, past 30 years, we've chosen not to rein in a lot of negative externalities, and we're paying the price. But I think we've been tricked, culturally and politically, we've been tricked into thinking that when you ask a company to do what the state should be doing or what public nonprofits should be doing, you're going to get a more efficient and more effective result. And I think all you have to do is look at the prison system in Texas or the public education system in this country and see that the privatization process doesn't always generate what we think it will. But it does make a few people very rich. And so those are the sorts of things I wanted us to think through. In the meantime, you know, keep using Google. Just be smarter and wiser about how you do it.
Siva, now is the time in the process of our meeting together where we invite some of our audience to also join the conversation. And I get to ask the first question.
Great.
Since you did write the Googleization of everything, what have you learned that you would put into Googleization 2.0, especially about books, since you had that experience?
Wow. I would not want to write another version of this. Because it is maddening, and because what I tried to do in this book is take a big picture view and try to outline some issues that I think are durable, that are going to be with us for 4 to 5 years. I published this book with the University Press, the University of California Press, so your local publisher. And I did so, I actually turned down offers from trade publishers because trade publishers are all about the quick kill, about the quick return. And I wanted this book to matter 3 to 5 years from now because I worked that long on it. You know, you don't want it to disappear after 6 months. And think, you know, walk through an airport bookstore and look at the books, especially books about business, and see how many of them are relevant 6 or 8 months, let alone 6 or 8 years later. So what would I do differently now? I think I still don't understand the technology as well as I would like. And I don't think I ever will. So I haven't scratched that itch, that curiosity about how the brilliant people who work on this stuff actually do their work. I think that part of the cost of rushing through to create a readable book is I had to slight my own education to some degree. I would actually like to know how people think through these problems in a much deeper way. I would like to hang out with the people who do this kind of work, and I didn't get a chance to do that. I wouldn't do it again in this form. I would just like to do it because I'm still curious about how this stuff happens. I fake it a little bit in terms of pretending to understand how this stuff works, but I'm perfectly willing to admit the limits of my knowledge. I want to know a lot more about computer science, about linguistics, about statistics, and about the sort of the unified intellectual field that is at work, not just at Google, but in computer science departments around the country, at other companies that are doing this sort of work. That stuff's really fascinating. I think that's some of the most mind-blowing mind work going on right now anywhere in the world. And just getting beyond the effects of this one company, I think we are just beginning to make sense of an era of big data where we have access to just so much information and we're trying to figure out the rules and regulations and ethics and methods that can really help make sense of this this time of abundance.
I want to remind our audience here at the Commonwealth Club and on the radio that we are listening to Brewster Kahle and Siva Vedananta, who are with us today on the subject of Googleization and the future of books. Are there questions from the audience? Please come and use the microphone if you would.
Thanks. Okay. There was a lot there and a lot of interesting stuff to talk about, but I wanted to focus in on, I guess, the opening and closing moments of your dialogue.
Mm.
Okay. You opened talking about the tension between anarchy and oligarchy in the digital world, and you closed with a note about what about private nonprofits and public organizations should be doing, saying that these things happen at this level. There's an interesting debate in our society, broadly, where organizations and institutions that we like, we call public, and those that we don't, we call government.
Hmm.
So public libraries, or for that matter, public broadcasting, sound like wonderful things everybody should want. Government-selected books or government-sponsored opinion journalism sound like horrible things we should stay away from. And it's because these things, the public is down at the distributed end, the government is the ultimate oligarchy.
Hmm.
Businesses all come somewhere in the middle. Small businesses close to the bottom, big businesses close to the top. So why is it that you believe that there is this sector called the private nonprofit sector or the public sector that is the appropriate locus for these activities, when in fact attempts at that in that sector didn't succeed, while one in the private sector seems to succeed?
I would contest your last point. I don't think the private sector has succeeded. I think the private sector has scanned, and that's not the same thing. I think Brewster has a lot to say about this whole process. In terms of this artificial distinction between public and government, we see this at work in political rhetoric in the United States. It doesn't fly for me. If we actually engage as citizens in a democratic republic, then the government is us. And the extent to which the government isn't us speaks to our own failure to take command. And it's going to be a constant struggle, right? Because oligarchic elements of any society are going to try to assert control in any sort of system. And it really is up to us to be vigilant and politically engaged. I worry about 100 different ways that we become politically disengaged. And relying on hoping for the mystical force from the clouds to come down and deliver to us great services, I think, is part of the process of depoliticization. And I think it ultimately hurts us more than it helps us. And you must have a lot to say about this, Brewster.
I'll take a different take. The things that I'm finding in the high-tech area that I find most exciting are happening in high-tech nonprofits. It's the Wikipedias, the EFFs, the Linuxes that are going on. Mozilla, the idea that out of the browser wars, a nonprofit could go and rise up against Microsoft and make a better browser is pretty astonishing. The ability to have large numbers of people work together without employing each other is a little radical from an economist's point of view, and it's happening.
Not from an anarchist point of view.
And San Francisco is a hotbed of this. Wikipedia moved here from Florida because we actually have here a pretty good sense of balance. So there's a new sector that didn't really exist when I was in college, as best I could tell, that were really operational, structural infrastructure nonprofits. So these aren't just philanthropy that just gives stuff, give money away. These are people that are building real infrastructure. There are precursors. There's a New York Public Library was done that way. And I think we're, maybe it's because we have this gilded age and too rich and the government sort of getting argued out of doing much of anything. We have something that I think is going on now that's governing the open source projects and now the open content projects, and they're fascinating.
Thank you.
These percentages of Google search market share in the United States and Europe, to me, are very scary, because these guys, I think, need some criticism. And I heard Stephen Levy here a couple weeks ago. He's a critic. If you criticize somebody who has a 60% market share of search, or 96%, it seems to me like they could make you not come up so high on the search results.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether that's happening, but I'll bet you that people are scared to try.
Yeah.
That people have something they would like to say about Google that's critical, but they are afraid to do so for fear of the power of those market shares. Have you seen any either of the fear or of the actual screwing up of the search so that the critics come out lower on the search? Because they could they could literally put people out of business by doing that.
They have put people out of business, but often accidentally. I mean, Google has Google's changed its algorithm so frequently that often small businesses find their links disappear onto page two or three, which might as well be nowhere. And there has been tremendous ramifications about that. That's a whole other story. I'm happy to report that Google's not petty, or nobody at Google that I've ever met is petty. And part of that has to do with being so rich, right? When you're rich, you don't have to be petty all the time, which is a way of saying, you know, actually, Donald Trump's not that rich. I mean, the guy couldn't run a profitable casino, right? I mean, think about that for a second. So, people at Google and Google as a company is fairly not only secure about their position and their role in the world and the fact that they have, you know, billions of users and hundreds of thousands of customers. And, of course, the customers are the advertisers. We're not the customers. And so they don't have to worry about the likes of me. And in fact, I found folks at Google nothing but welcoming and open. And as I've raised issues, especially about the Books Project over the years, I mean, I sat down with the director of the Books Program about 2 years ago, and he gave me 3 hours of his time. We just sat there drinking coffee and working through every detail and going back and forth and arguing and with a tremendous amount of mutual respect. And no, my books are still findable through Google Books. My web pages are still findable through Google. And I don't expect that to change at any time. I'm just a professor, right? So what the heck? I intentionally did not capitulate to the search engine optimization imperatives with this book. You, in the title or subtitle of this book, well, there's no subtitle, but in the title of this book, you will not see the word Google. The word is Googleization. So that means if you Google Google, you won't find my book. If you go to Amazon and you type in Google, you will find a lot of books about Google, but not my book. Had I used the word Google in the title, it would have been clunky and awkward, and I would have been doing so only to show up higher in search results. And I just didn't want to do that. I hope no one from University of California Press is here right now, because they won't be happy about that story. But it was sort of a little sly move, like Sisyphus being happy as he rolls the rock up the hill. But you know, I did what I could. So yeah, we have to be wary of the powerful. In this case, Google is powerful in such a soft way. Its power is so soft, and its role in the world is so secure, and it's so rich. That its methods of influence are far from coercive, and that's actually why we need to pay more attention to it. It is not a bully. It is in some ways a clumsy baby, and things get broken by clumsy babies as much as they get broken by bullies. But you know, it just means we have to watch it in a different way.
So, I'd watch for monopolies, and I think the Google Books project was something that really laid bare a part of Google that really wasn't as apparent in other areas. So there's sort of three sectors of books. There's out of copyright, there's out of print, and there's in print. And they basically went at it with a structure that was clever and fabulously well executed. You go and lock up the public domain by going and doing secret contracts with the people that actually have the old books in their collections. For the out-of-print works, you go and do this class action suit, weird rewrite copyright in a district court, woo, thing that's fabulously clever. Not great, but fabulously clever. And then the in-print area, I've talked with publishers that have tried actually putting books up on their own websites, and they don't get very good hits. They have to go and put it into Google's book system. So this sort of basically taking apart the book industry and that part of the information sphere is something you can do if you're as centralized and controlling as Google is, and as, frankly, as clever. These guys are smarter than hell. So watch out for monopoly in general. It may not be the little guys that are crushed. It might be whole industries.
Could you please approach the microphone so that the radio audience can hear you too?
I'm wondering how the Internet Archive has dealt with the issues of copyright with your digitization project and in working with libraries.
How's the Internet Archive dealt with copyright?
Unfortunately, this will be our last question.
Boy, is copyright confusing. There's a wonderful book by Jessica Littman called Digital Copyright that tries to explain how do we get into this mess. I mean, Ben Franklin did 14 years renewable once, right? That was as long as it took for Ben Franklin to go and exploit his thing before it became public domain, right? He was a publisher. That was pretty straightforward. You translate it, it's a new work, go nuts. Jessica Littman wrote this book and said even copyright attorneys can't understand copyright. So I'm mere layman, really have no clue. It's complicated. So what we try to do is things that smell good. And we just try to move forward. And we try to say basically, all right, what did we sign up for, right? I've got librarian in my title. We're supposed to be librarians. What does that mean? We buy stuff and we lend it out. That's what we do. And so we've basically been taking things from when it's available for free, like the web, we just gather it up and we lend it out. So people come to us and say, I want to reprint this page from Google's old website or Yahoo's old website, and we want you to sign over the rights to it. It's like, it's not ours. We're a library. It's on our shelves. You're as if you're taking it from a library. And people that are old enough to remember what libraries are like, okay, it's not terribly facetious here. That's working. So on the book side, we started with the public domain materials, digitized that, and made it available with no restrictions. So we put no new restrictions. And so we've had sort of a motto of just don't put new restrictions on. If things are rights burdened, like the 20th century materials that don't have a market, that sort of are just kind of languishing, there's a high up person in the copyright office that said, who's going to complain? And I think some of that is right. Another thing I learned from one of the former deputy librarians of Congress was be respectful. And I think that's absolutely crucial, too. Do a good job of it. If you're going to take somebody's old book, digitize it, and make it available to their grandkids, do it well, right? Don't have blurry pages. Don't screw it up. So we've done that, and that's generally worked. We've generally said what it is we're interested in. We try to make things work all the way around. So now on the copyright front, what we're doing is we're buying ebooks from publishers so that we can lend them out. We want publishers to exist. We want lots of publishers to exist. We want the next generation of authors to get paid. We have $3 or $4 billion collectively to get this done if we don't screw it up.
So you haven't been threatened with lawsuits because of the work you're doing?
We're not really. Yeah. You know, people get pissed off at us for going and archiving their web pages, usually is the issue. Things that they didn't mean to be up forever, and then they found it, and the Wayback Machine is like, boo! And they write to us, sometimes kind of upset, and we take it out. And that seems to work quite well. We're responsive. We don't have an endless voicemail tree. We don't outsource our customer service to another country. We have people that work for us in San Francisco that answer the phone, hopefully on the first or second ring, and we try to deal respectfully with things that we know were written by others. We're just custodians of the cultural heritage.
Great.
Again, Siva, I'm going to do it right this time. Vedianthan?
Almost.
And Brewster Kahle, we thank you so much for your comments today. We also want to thank our audiences here at the club as well as our radio audience. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.
Appreciate it.